You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, September 1st, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor Julie Ingersoll of the University of North Florida, on her book, Rebuilding God's Kingdom, Inside the World of Christian Reconstructionism. And just in time, as Rick Perry, let me see if I could work in a lot of religious puns, in a serious Hail Mary, tries to convince his followers to help him overturn the tables of the money changers and ask them to get loaded as they head to Washington. It's just unbelievable sound. Also on the program today, Pope calls for a jubilee for a year. Priests now have the option to forgive Catholic women who've had an abortion. Bernie Sanders in striking distance in Iowa. We'll also talk a little bit about that mini debate I had last night on MSNBC about the debate schedule. Meanwhile, Scott Walker, build a wall to the south, build a wall to the north. I got to think that maybe we could use one on the east and west. They'd have to be very, very high. Stop any airplanes or missiles. I mean, also, Rand Paul has his own email problem now, or at least one of his supporters does. And the right wing freaks out because a Tesla car got a great review in Consumer Reports. That is not an Onion story. And old friend Jonathan Alter has come out and written a piece as to why liberals should love charters. Maybe we'll have him back on. We had Jonathan Alter on the program, I guess it was now 3 years ago, I feel like. 2012. And we were arguing over, I believe it was his embrace for a raise in the age of retirement or with Medicare or both. And he was arguing for cuts to Social Security. I was arguing not a good idea. I don't know that I convinced him, but I haven't read an article about it since then. Maybe we should do the same about charters. But we will get to that. I also should tell you folks, later in the week, we're going to do a pre-record for Thursday. I'm not sure what's going to happen on Friday. We'll have a pre-record for Labor Day. The pre-record we're doing on Thursday, I am literally giddy about this, will be a deep dive into the Social Security Disability Insurance Fund. And there is no stranger feeling than coming to the realization that you're actually like jittery with excitement about doing an interview over the SSDI. I mean, really, it is a very strange feeling when you get that level of self-awareness. But that's what gets me excited. I'm also excited for the Pats to beat the Steelers next Monday, despite all of this hullabaloo about Deflategate, whatnot. We'll find out if Tom Brady is playing. I would guess he's probably not going to be. I don't know when he'll take his suspension. It's still, apparently, they're still negotiating. But let's talk fantasy football for a minute, because I know we have fantasy football players in this audience. FanDuel Week 1 games are almost here. Now, FanDuel, I don't know if you're familiar with this, is the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and payouts than any other site. This is amazing. I had no idea. But they're paying out over $75 million a week this football season. They have a salary cap format. You can pick any players you want for just 1 week. Entry fees start at just $1. Anyone can play. So if you are someone who loves to watch football games and loves fantasy football, or I guess if you're also a rotisserie baseball fan, you may want to go to FanDuel.com, click on the microphone that's in the upper right-hand corner, and use my code MAJOR, as in majority, but just stop at MAJOR. Sign up now. You get a special offer for new users. For every dollar that you deposit, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of $200. Offer's only good for the first 50 people that use the code MAJOR today. Don't forget to use the code MAJOR. I mean, you could try it tomorrow. I don't know when you're hearing this, but try it. It's FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. That's FanDuel.com. Sign up today, coupon code MAJOR. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Julie Ingersoll. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Julie Ingersoll. She's a professor at the University of North Florida, writer, posts at the Huffington Post and Religion Dispatches, and author of the newly published Rebuilding God's Kingdom Inside the World of Christian Reconstructionism. Welcome to the program, Julie.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you know, there's a couple. I mean, I'm sort of fascinated by this. I've heard the words Christian Reconstructionism thrown around over the years, and I don't know that I've quite really had a grip on what it is. And certainly, I don't have the experience of the touchstones to know when I'm hearing about it in the course of hearing people speak. You know, I'm just not sensitive to where the influences lie. So if you would, let's start with just sort of a broad explanation or description of what the Reconstructionist movement is and when it, I guess, it started in this country.
Okay, great. And I think it sounds to me like you have already read the book, because that's really one of my primary goals for the book, is that when people have written about Christian Reconstructionists, for the most part, in public discourse, they have done it in a way that is extraordinarily inflammatory, and they've emphasized some of the really disturbing things that Reconstructionists have said. But in doing that, I think that they have diverted attention to some of the things that aren't quite as far out and unlikely to happen, and actually missed the places where there is influence. So to start really at the beginning with your question, Christian Reconstruction is a conservative Christian movement that was started in the 1960s by a theologian named Rusus John Rush Juni. And he wrote extensively to revise conservative Christian views about the relationship between the Bible, both the Old Testament and the New Testament, and everyday life, really. And there's kind of two focuses there that are the most important to understand to get started. And one of them is the argument that really any kind of neutrality between religion and non-religion, or between their version of religion and other forms of religion, any kind of neutrality is for them philosophically impossible. And then in addition to that, Rush Juni developed this framework in which he applied the Bible to every aspect of life by thinking about these spheres of authority, all of which are under God. So he kind of divided up what he believed to be this authority delegated by God into authority related to the family, authority related to the church, and authority related to the civil government.
And so where did, I want to get back to both those notions, the notion of you can't really be neutral. You're either, I guess, with us or against us in that sense. And these sort of three spheres of authority. But what was it reaction to? I mean, what was Rush Juni reacting to? Was it just simply these are ideas that he had for a long time? Or was it a reaction to things that were happening in society or in his church?
Well, I mean, I think the cultural upheavals of the 1960s were certainly part of the impetus. And Rush Juni and many of his, like the first generation of followers kind of around him, like Gary North and others, were also deeply involved in the anti-communist movement. Many of them were members of the John Birch Society. So I think that they saw a world in which they understood faithfulness as intimately tied to kind of American form of government and capitalism over against the threat of communism. And I think that's very much where they started.
And so let's go, because I want to circle back to that notion, because when we talk about sort of the Reconstructionist perspective on economics, but that notion of neutrality, and then the second notion of the three spheres of authority. Why break those spheres up if it's all under God? Or explain to us how that works.
Well, because I think that this was one of Rush Juni's most important contributions. Because this notion of sphere sovereignty, that's what the label of it was, it actually dates back to the Reformation. But Rush Juni's particular version of it made this bridge between his assertion that the Bible speaks to every area of life, and that biblical law, as it's contained in the Old Testament and the New Testament, remains applicable. So if you start there, then you've got to say, well, how do we apply it? What kinds of policies are dictated by biblical law? What kind of cultural, social arrangements are dictated? And for that, he goes to this notion of sphere sovereignty. So it was a mechanism that allowed him to take the assertion that the Bible speaks to every area of life and explain how that might be so, and think and talk to Christians about how to make it apply to every aspect of life.
And so let's start with family. I mean, how does this play out in family? I mean, I think it's I mean, one can guess, but tell us how it plays out in family.
Well, for Rushdie, the family was the most important of these spheres of authority. And he saw families as having specific responsibility for raising children to exercise dominion, and sort of all economic activity is under the authority of the family for him. Certainly, it's a family structure that you would imagine, right? It's patriarchal, with, you know, women in submission. And these days, with the Quiverful movement, it's understood to have the requirement of actually procreating as much as possible. Although that kind of traces back to Rushdie, but that wasn't exactly present in Rushdie's early work.
So that sort of set the table, I guess, for Quiverful.
Yeah. In fact, one of the most important places where you have the development of Quiverful, and another name for it is biblical patriarchy, one of the most important places you find that is in the now defunct ministry of Doug Phillips out of San Antonio, Texas. And he is explicitly drawing on Rushdie and his development of it.
And we should say that the Quiverful, I mean, if people have recognized that term, it is because it's been in the news quite a bit, because that is supposedly the movement that the Duggars, I've never watched the TV show, but the guy's been in the news quite a bit lately, that the Duggars, I guess, subscribe to. And so...
In fact, Doug Phillips' organization gave Michelle Duggar the Mother of the Year Award a couple of years back. So there's definitely interaction between those two examples of it.
And talk about in the context of the church, because I'm trying to get to, like, you know, what is the difference between what we call the religious right and what is and Reconstructionists, and is there a difference, and how does it play out in the way that in these three different spheres? Because from a family perspective, it seems, broadly speaking, and maybe, I don't know, you tell me if I'm wrong, but broadly speaking, it seems like the religious right is, you know, also fairly patriarchal. I mean, and it doesn't seem dramatically different to me.
Well, okay, so the first question about the responsibility of the church under this division is to preach the gospel. But, of course, Christian Reconstructionists understand that as really sort of tutoring people in this kind of broad exercise of dominion. So for Christian Reconstructionists, preaching the gospel isn't like it is for many other contemporary Protestants, just sort of talking about the, you know, this, talking about sin and salvation and the resurrection and the risk, you know. So for many Christians, you'll have a Sunday morning service where there'll be, you know, this exhortation to accept Jesus as your Savior, and it kind of only goes that far. But Reconstructionists are really critical of that notion of what it means to preach the gospel. And for them, it's definitely a sort of lifelong mentorship and tutoring on the part of the church, which actually has a level of ecclesiastical authority. So they advocate church courts and various other kinds of things to resolve differences of agreement and controversies. With regard to the ties between the Reconstructionists and the religious right, I think that's a really important question. That's kind of what runs through the books that I wrote, because I don't think that... in one way, the Reconstructionists and the religious rights aren't exactly the same organizations, right? So the people who are leaders in the religious right would deny the influence of Rushdie and the Reconstructionists. And the Reconstructionists look at the religious right and say that they have failed because they've implemented different parts of what Reconstructionists advocate, but they've done it inconsistently.
Well,
people like David Barton, for example. David Barton totally uses that three-part notion of God's ordained authority to think through various policies. So, you know, his radio show did an extensive discussion about net neutrality last year, and he invoked that framework to explain why it wasn't within the biblical purview of the authority of civil government to enforce policies related to net neutrality. So you see that stuff playing out in the religious right in ways that if you haven't, like if you don't know that framework and you don't know where that framework came from, you wouldn't recognize that that's Rushdoony's influence when David Barton uses it. But once you understand the language and the frameworks that he put forth, you hear them all over the place in religious right.
Okay, so a guy like, I mean, you know, for those of us who are not as sort of fluent in this stuff, so a guy like David Barton, he is an evangelical, you know, I guess political activist, and you know. Has media stuff, I guess, as well. And he, for instance, and this gets us into the third sphere. He says that the Constitution does not create a separation between church and state. From the perspective of a Reconstructionist, like that question is even moot, because the Constitution, doesn't matter what the Constitution says one way or another, because God has sovereignty over all that. Is that right?
Indeed, they would say that they believe in a separation of church and state, right? Because God ordained some authority to church and some authority to state, but not a separation of church and state the way that you and I might use the term. They disagree a little bit amongst themselves as to the degree to which the Constitution is sort of reframing what they would understand to be a biblical order. Barton would say that it does, but he's kind of peripheral to Reconstructionists. He doesn't identify with that label, and they wouldn't necessarily identify him as one of them. But that's why I think he's a good case study, because you actually can hear all of the Reconstructionist language in the way that he talks about things, even though they would reject him and he would reject them.
But on what grounds would they reject each other? I mean, for someone with untrained ears, like, you know, what is it? Where are the big lines of demarcation?
Well, one of the things that happens all the time is people who espouse the views that Reconstructionists have articulated for over 50 years and participate in events with them and go to their conferences and give lectures and do all kinds of things say, no, I'm not one of them. But they never explain where they disagree. So, for example, Herb Titus, who's a sort of prominent Christian lawyer, was affiliated with Oral Roberts University Law School, and then I think it was Pat Robertson's University's Law School. He sounds just like one. I've heard him speak at several of their conferences. He's had ties with them forever, and yet he says he's not one, but he never says, I'm not a Reconstructionist because I don't do X, Y, and Z. There's never a demarcation there. A lot of them don't want to affiliate with Reconstructionists because of some of the things I alluded to at the very beginning of the conversation. So Rushdoony argued that slavery is biblical, and many of his contemporary followers hold to that view. They want to reinstitute Old Testament biblical law, so they believe in the death penalty for all manner of things, including homosexuality. So what often happens in the media is people will say, oh, Rushdoony, who believed that slavery was biblical and there should be a death penalty for homosexuality, they use that phrase, and then they stop. Because, thankfully, we're not on the verge of having death penalty for homosexuality or reinstituting slavery. So if you think of only those two issues, it's easy to dismiss Reconstructionists as irrelevant. But if you recognize that for 50 years they've argued for the privatization of public education or the privatization of the prison system, when you get kind of down in the weeds with the stuff that's not as far-fetched, you find that they have all kinds of support for the things that they've promoted over the years. The Christian school movement and the Christian homeschool movement directly have its roots in the work of Rushdoony.
And I want to touch, give us a sense of, like, how many Reconstructionists are there in the country? Do we have a sense of that?
You can't really answer it. It's, first of all, again, the argument that I'm making is that there are lots of people who are shaped and influenced by Reconstructionism in ways that they don't even recognize.
Right.
So, you know, if you do a survey and you say, so, are you a Christian Reconstructionist? There's going to be very few people who say yes.
I mean, are we talking like? Are there
organizations that are explicitly identified as Reconstructionists? But my point is that there are many more that are subtly influenced by it in ways that aren't even recognized.
And
there are a handful of Reconstructionist churches here and there, but it's more of a movement and a philosophical perspective, a theological perspective, than it is an organization where you could count members.
And so is it, I mean, how much is it, I mean, let's talk about those things about the sort of the anti-public schooling. Where does that come from, I guess, philosophically and within the context of their belief system? And then how...
That goes directly back to that three-part division. That's a great example, actually, because it's a way of illustrating how that works. So the responsibility for raising children is solely placed in the context of the family. And the civil government has, in this framework, has no authority at all with regard to education of children. And so, and Rushdie made this argument very early. And when I say the homeschool movement is deeply rooted in Rushdie, that's not to say that homeschoolers are all Reconstructionists. But what many homeschoolers may not realize is that very early on, Rushdie was involved in legal cases and making an argument in court that this was a basic issue of fundamental religious freedom. And so there were lots of ways in which the courts recognized autonomy for parents to choose for the education of their children. And organizations that have continued this work of Rushdie have largely established a legal structure across the country where homeschooling is often completely unregulated. And in places where it is regulated by the civil government, organizations consistently make the argument that it shouldn't be. So there's this idea that, that education is completely in the realm of the family, and any intrusion by the state for any level of regulation is considered a violation of religious freedom, and it's considered tyranny because it's usurping authority that doesn't belong, in their view, to the civil government.
Does this whole construction of, you know, I just watched a video today of a county clerk in Rowan County.
Yeah, I've been watching that one myself and thinking about this.
Kim Davis, I was wondering, you know, and she's refusing to follow the law of the land and refusing to issue a marriage license for a male couple. And
yes.
To what extent, I mean, are we seeing a situation like that and also this movement of, I mean, we're hearing, you know, the context of people are getting access to contraception is an infringement upon, it's quashing my Christian liberty. To what extent does that idea come out of this movement?
I think tremendously so. Yeah, I was watching those same videos this morning and thinking about this. Rushdie wrote in the late 60s that's the direction that religious liberty claims would ultimately go. You know, if you listen to the woman who's her name is Davis, that county clerk, she said that she was refusing to do this under God's authority. And she goes to an apostolic church, which is a Pentecostal church. But in the 1980s, there was some interesting overlap between some aspects of Pentecostalism and one of Rushdie's followers, Gary North, and he introduced a lot of the frameworks and ideas of Reconstructionism to some Pentecostal churches. And so I don't know, I only know about Davis's religious views from what appears in the court document that the Supreme Court rejected. So I don't know for sure how affiliated she is. But there was a time, you know, in the colonial era, the strongest proponents of the separation of church and state, as you and I might understand it, were the Baptists, because they believed that that the civil government should have no involvement in religious concerns at all. And they totally believed that there was possible for this neutral sphere of influence so persons would have a private, personal religious concern, but that the public sphere could exist in a way that was neutral and in some ways secular or at least separate from religion. But Rushdie argued that that's just not possible. And I think that his view that a secular public sphere is ultimately going to collide with the Reconstructionist version of how society ought to look. I mean, he saw them as inescapably irreconcilable. And I think that the view that those are irreconcilable, I think that view has made its way into some important aspects of American Christianity. Certainly not all of them, right? You know, lots of people argue that the New Testament says that Christians should submit to civil authority, render under Caesar, right? But many others argue that this way in which our society is organized such that people have the right to do personally whatever they want with regard to religion, and that we have a neutral secular public sphere where we can sort of all get along with each other despite our religious disagreements. Reconstructionism says that that's not possible, and that ultimately is not reconcilable with the way they want to structure the world.
So in other words, they want to live in a theocracy.
Yes.
And so talk to me about these three concepts that you discuss. Presuppositionalism, postmillennialism, which is a little bit, that's a little bit hair-raising for me. I'm perfectly willing to live in a Millenistic era. You know, that is, if Jesus comes back, I'm willing to give up the ghost and say, all right, you win. And then theonomy. Maybe I'm not pronouncing that right. We talk about those three concepts?
I will, although this is difficult to do without getting down in the weeds, right? And sometimes I think it's easier to read those things than it is to listen to them because of the technical language. But briefly, presuppositionalism is that philosophical idea that there's no neutrality. So a Reconstructionist argues that all knowledge starts with some assumptions that are not provable. And for Reconstructionists, there's only two categories of such knowledge. There's the revealed will of God in the Bible, and there's everything else. And so this is where you get the idea that neutrality is impossible. It's also where you get the idea, like in the 1980s when conservative Christians were really concerned about secular humanism. That comes directly out of this. And many of the religious right leaders, like, say, Tim LaHaye, who wrote about this concern over secular humanism in the 80s, he cites Rushdoony in his book. That's right where it comes from.
And so basically when you say there's either the word of God and then there's everything else, it's either basically there's truth and then there's just a bunch of lies that people live.
Well, yeah, although they don't think that it's the relevant point that makes them hang together isn't just that they are lies. It's that they derive from a view that human reason can be autonomous from God's authority and God's law. So either you're going to take what God says or you're going to try to figure it out on your own. And if you try to figure it out on your own, you're going to get all manner of things ranging from, you know, every other religion in the world, every ideological system, every perspective that's not self-consciously rooted in biblical law.
Okay.
And so then that's the presuppositionalism. Postmillennialism is a category of a religious structure that we call eschatology, which is really theologies about end times stuff. The one that we hear the most about in our contemporary world is premillennialism. That is, Jesus will come back before the millennium. There'll be a kingdom of God that's established when Jesus returns. And that's the viewpoint. The contemporary version of that is, where you have the rapture and the battle of Armageddon and the great tribulation, and the thing of many movies and all of that. So that's presupposition. I mean, that's
right. And that's where Jesus shows up first, right?
Not necessarily.
Oh,
the
okay.
Early church was sort of a mixture of these things. In particular, the premillennialism that I just described is a 19th century thing.
Okay.
But Christian Reconstructionists are postmillennialists. They think that the kingdom of God was established at the resurrection and that it's the job of Christians to build it and that Jesus will come at the end of it. That's why it's postmillennial. So Jesus will come at the culmination of it.
So in other words,
this is the view that the 19th century evangelicals who fought for women's right to vote and abolition, they were postmillennialists. So it doesn't necessarily dictate a specific kind of political ideology.
It just dictates a certain level of activism.
I would think so. Yeah. Yeah. They see it as their job to transform the world according to what they understand the gospel to require.
And then theonomy.
It's theonomy, and it literally just means the application of biblical law to every aspect of life. And it's kind of a corollary to the presuppositionalism, right? So if there's only two kinds of knowledge, there's God's law there's God, there's knowledge that comes from God's revelation, and then there's everything else that presupposes the sufficiency of human reason. Then you have to say, well, how does that get applied? And it gets applied through this, through biblical law, which theonomy is just the idea that God's law is still applicable.
So where does all this head? I mean, in other words, if these ideas are out there floating around, and if one sort of was aware that this stuff like the anti-public school perspective, or even anti-public prisons, if these things were sort of floating around there and sort of being injected into the bloodstream of the religious right, are there other ideas that are out there that you see? And because of your background, I mean, I should say that, you know, you experienced some of this, a lot of this firsthand in some respects. Do you see this stuff gaining currency? Are there other ideas that you see gaining currency in the religious right that in 5 or 10 years we may see more of or hear more of?
Well, I think that the next big front for these battles is going to be the aftermath of marriage equality and the decision there. I mean, I think that that's going to, in fact, I'm teaching a course, Religion in the Courts, right now, and that's what we're going to focus on the whole term, because the courts are going to have to sort out exactly how we make sense out of a commitment to non-discrimination and equality in the context of a long-standing traditional commitment in the U.S. to defer to people's religious commitments. And those are going to be complicated cases, right? I don't think, you know, when the decision came out, there were people saying, oh, well, there's going to be pastors going to jail. No, I don't think there are going to be pastors going to jail. But there's all kinds of different levels to this, right? So, you know, there are questions about what churches would have to do or not do, and I just don't see the courts ever forcing a church to perform a same-sex marriage, for example. But the case that you cited in Kentucky, here you have an employee of the civil government, and is, you know, does she exercise her responsibilities in her job as a private citizen who has religious freedom, or is she required to meet the secular demands of the civil government? And I think we're going to see controversy after controversy with that. You know, there's the cases with regard to people who own businesses and whether or not they have to provide services for same-sex marriage. So those are going to vary, too. You know, perhaps making a cake and sending it off with a person who's about to go to a same-sex marriage, perhaps that might be seen as not too onerous an infringement on rights. But, you know, for a photographer who has to attend the wedding and sort of be part of it, that might look a little different to the court. So I think each one of those cases is going to have to be adjudicated, and I think it's going to be as longstanding and controversial as the efforts to decide what it means to have public schools not promoting religion. You know, we had our school prayer decisions in the 60s, but we still regularly have controversies over, you know, what someone can wear to school and what counts as a, you know, can they have after-school meetings, and it's, you know, we're 50 years out and we still haven't really resolved how those two things are going to interact with each other on that case. And I think that the controversies over same-sex marriage and religious freedom claims are going to be the same.
Julie Ingersoll, professor, University of North Florida. The book is Rebuilding God's Kingdom Inside the World of Christian Reconstructionism. Thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half of the program where we'll hear Rick Perry really getting assertive, trying to show that he's man enough to stay in this race. But it's weird. It is weird. The visual is almost weirder because he's like dancing around, getting really into it. I think he may have just said, like, you know, it's possible he may have just said, F this. Like, I've been off whatever it is I was taking 4 years ago. That's not helping. So I'm going back on it. You know what I mean? I mean, I think, like, at one point, you're like, well, it's like Chris Christie, I bet, is now like, yeah, I think he's probably, you know, gone back to, he's no more like protein shakes for breakfast. I think he's gone, he's hitting, you know, I think he's basically said like, I'm not going to win. So I'm not going to, focus on losing this weight. Cause I mean,
focus on losing the election.
That's
not
right.
Losing the weight.
I think really he's got to focus on keeping out of prison. We will also, when we return, talk about Scott Walker's, it continues to happen. It's not just that Trump is leading in the polls and, you know, and also Carson. It is also that he is forcing all of them. And God, man, I just love, like, this was such a dream team of a Republican bench. These guys are clowns, man. They can't. They look really weak. Ben Carson is leading all of them except for Trump. It really is stunning. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half, the number 646-257-3920. Ladies and gentlemen, this program relies on its members to continue day in, day out, day in, day out. You can be one of those people who make it possible for us to do this program. And as a bonus, we give you a bunch of extra content. I want to say an extra 50 minutes a day. But it ends up being, I don't know when the last time we stayed within that. Maybe we'll stay within it today. Even if we don't give it to you for over 2 days, we more than made up for it the week before. So become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Everybody gets a fair wage throughout that entire process. It's co-op. That's why it's .coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, another shooting of an unarmed man. I think this one's in Texas. It was just crazy. We'll get to in the final half. I mean, the fun half. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. You'll notice no difference. We get a kickback. We'll be right back after this.